lengthy thing, but I'll, and it'll be, I'll have to kind of do a grasshopper thing, jump from one to the other.
That's perfectly fine.
I want to test it first, make sure we're getting good volume.
No, I feel sure it is. Go ahead.
Okay, let's see. What's today? Wednesday, Tuesday, the 15th?
Right.
Of December 1998.
Right, good.
And 4:33 o'clock. Let's see. Okay.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, I'll run that back and why not? A little bit, but yeah, you're right. It is. This, by the way, is the book I want to have a second go at. I did that for a German publisher only, and 25 years ago. And I never found right away a U.S. publisher for it, and went on to other things. And with this Von Braun celebration coming up, and all these, the millennium, and all these milestone anniversaries, so I'm probably going to about double that original manuscript and update things.
Mm-hmm. You wrote this in German, of course.
You know, I've never asked her, my good friend Ruth von Sarma. I think she may have translated it for a fee or a favor for the publisher. So all I have is my English manuscript.
I took 4 years of college German, but I couldn't order a sandwich. well.
So I'm going to go back and do this in English. And,
okay.
And I know you were quite close to him.
Well, yes and no. I think we had a very amiable relationship. Of course, his wife was actually she attended Nativity, and we treated her as a communicant, even though I don't think we had a record of her ever transferring there. And she may have remained a Lutheran too, as he did. But
I wondered about that, if they had actually converted or
she was a lovely person, and of course much a different personality, more retiring than he was. I did baptize his young son Peter, and presented the girls for confirmation. So they, as a family, were affiliated with Nativity. That's the best right word I can use. When he would go on speaking engagements often, afterward I would receive a check made out to the church where he had endorsed it over to the church, his honorarium, and usually around $500, and it was, you know, very much appreciated. But he would attend on occasions and some services and some special functions, but not as a communicant or as a regular member.
Let me just ask you this. They did not attend the Lutheran Church, though.
No.
Okay.
I don't think so.
To your knowledge.
Yeah, to my knowledge, they were affiliated with Nativity.
Mm-hmm.
I think they considered that their church. I don't remember how and when I became acquainted with Werner, but somehow I did, and we had fairly soon a first name basis friendship, and I could call and get his secretary and get through to him if we had something to talk about. One of the things that brought us together, I'm sure, was hunting. And Harry Rett used to have him out for dove shoots and things, and I encountered him there a few times. But the most memorable encounters I had with him were deer hunting trips. I invited him to go on a hunting trip down to Greensboro, Alabama.
You invited him?
Yeah. My late Nicholas Hamner Cobb, he was a descendant of the first Episcopal Bishop of Alabama by that name, Nicholas Hamner Cobb.
C-O-B-B.
Right. Pardon?
C-O-B-B.
Yeah.
Cobb, right.
And he has a son in Greensboro now who is the same name. And it's called Nick. He's a lawyer. Hamner, he went by the name of Hamner, he was the owner and the editor of the Greensboro Watchman, a weekly newspaper, a very good weekly newspaper. And he enjoyed a reputation of being either conservative liberal or liberal conservative. For a Southerner, he was regarded as more of a liberal person than you would expect, especially on social issues in the church. Actually, I think that may be how we met. We were at a synod meeting of our church and sat next to each other and probably struck up a conversation and about hunting and things. I think that is where we met. And the synod meeting was somewhere in the Carolinas. I don't remember exactly where. But he was a landowner, had a plantation of 3,000 or 4,000 acres of nice bottom land. And it was beautiful. Deep woods, hard woods, and the deer were roaming through it, and turkey. And so he had some really great deer hunts. That was in the days where we had dog hunts. The dogs would be turned loose, of course. A few drivers, usually young black males that worked for him, would go through hollering and whooping, and the stand would be put out on stands, and the deer, of course, would be driven toward us. That's the way they hunted, and still done in some parts of the South now, but mostly they don't allow the dogs anymore to run. Well, I had been down there on a number of occasions and taken a few guests from Huntsville, and we always were treated like special guests. Hamner had a black cook named Sack, S-A-K, and she looked like a sack, human sack. But she could get in there on an old wood stove and cook the best meal you ever ate in your life. I mean, chicken and dumplings and turnip greens and something she called an egg pie and all sorts of wonderful desserts. And this was a kind of a ramshackle camp house. I've got a picture of it upstairs with a screen porch all the way around it. And kitchen kind of added on room, you know. So one of the things didn't burn down. It did later, but not from the kitchen.
Right.
Well,
lodge would be
And it had several bedroom places for people to sleep. And so after Warren and I had, Hamner had gotten me established as a regular hunter, I felt free to invite Werner one time to go with me. So we did, and we but he had a pilot. Mm-hmm. Pilot name was something Dean, first name Dean, and I can't remember his last name. But we went down in that plane and Werner had one or two of his assistants with him and myself. And then several other friends from Huntsville drove down, so we had a good Huntsville contingent.
Mm-hmm.
So we arrived at the airport, and I think it was late enough in the evening, they had to put cars along the runway to turn the lights on for us to land by.
Mm.
But we, of course, were received royally. I think the mayor was there, a few newspaper people, and Werner was given the welcome that he deserved, and we went down, and he had, I think at that time they pretty well were asking him to stay in touch with headquarters because of uncertainty of foreign relations and all. So I think he had a field telephone with him, so he could radio telephone.
Was this in the 60s?
Uh-huh.
Early, mid, late?
Yeah, we came to Huntsville in 57, so
right.
It had to be in the early 60s.
Okay.
So we were there and enjoyed the hospitality and got out in the deep woods and, well, honey, well, the anecdote about this trip is our host, Hamlet Cobbs, had a old green pickup truck that he drove 60 to 70 or 80 miles an hour through the woods and across the pasture. And God have mercy on you if you weren't up front in the cab, but most everybody had to ride in the back of the truck. Well, we were getting ready to load up, and one of Hamner Cobb's friends, and I call him his field lieutenant to help run the hunt, said, Hamner, you better put Doc Von Braun up front in the cab with you. He said, hell no, let him ride in the back like everybody else. he had a colorful language.
Right.
And,
was it within Werner's earshot?
Oh, yeah. And Werner loved it. He laughs and just laughed. I think it was a phrase, like everybody else, that appealed to him.
Uh-huh.
But he had been treated with such deference everywhere he went, you know, and probably was ready to be one of the boys, just one of the... So he rode the back of the truck with the dogs, the black drivers, and a few of us hunters, and just had a great time. It wasn't a long ride. We're talking about maybe a few miles, bumping across pasture land and down the dirt road, the field road, but we got there safely and hunted safely. I don't remember whether we had a kill or not, but we always kill some deer, but I don't know whether anybody in our party got anything.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the Greensboro
hunting
experience.
Hell no, let him ride in the back on the hill.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't too long after that Werner returned the favor and invited me to go with him on a hunting trip to Arkansas. And this time he flew, I think, his own plane, at least if not, he was the pilot.
Mm-hmm. He did a lot of that.
Yeah, he did, and he was a good pilot. I was sitting right behind him in one of the seats. There were only about four of us in the plane. I can't remember whether it was a twin engine or a single engine. Probably twin engine. It was twin engine. Yeah.
Now this was up to Arkansas?
Someplace in Arkansas. And we landed at some little airstrip near where we're going to hunt. And we were met with Jeep, and we had a long Jeep ride from the airstrip to the hunting camp, which was in the very deep, deep woods of Arkansas. Beautiful woods. Well, Warren and I were only two passengers in the back of the Jeep. We sat back there with a bottle of Chivas Regal, a bucket of ice, and two paper cups. And when we reached the camp, there wasn't a drop of Chivas Regal left or a cube of ice. And we were feeling very good. Very relaxed.
I understand.
Actually, it was probably we needed that to anesthetize us from the bumpy ride over there.
And it was not necessarily a terribly long ride, but it was into the deep woods.
I think we were probably at least 30 minutes going into the deep woods, yeah. Oh, it would take not long to finish off a bottle of Chivas.
Well, yeah.
It was somewhere between 30 minutes and an hour, and we were in the really deep woods. And
sure.
They got out his radio equipment and made sure everything was okay. It was on that hunt, on these hunts you're usually led into the woods by someone who knows how to put you off on what's called a stand.
Now was this a wild boar or deer?
No, white-tailed deer.
White-tailed deer.
Both of these hunts.
Okay.
So this white man, took us in and very considerate and courteous and solicitous. He said, all right, now I'll put you here, and when you get ready to come out, if you want, we can come back and get you, or you can just walk straight that way. And well, I looked and I lined up some trees that I knew exactly how to get out of there, and I'd done this so many times I had no worry. We were on the stand maybe hour and a half or 2 hours, and I had not shot or had any action, but came time to leave by appointment. We had our time that we would walk out, so I started out in the direction I was supposed to go out, and I came to a stream. I said, whoa, we did not cross any stream when we came in here.
Right.
Oh my God, I'm turned around, and I was. Well, I had sense enough not to panic or to wander around aimlessly, so I went back to where I thought I'd been and sat down and waited. And so, sure enough, they began to miss me and began to look for me. And I heard some car horn blowing and some shouting, so I fired my rifle 3 times, and someone came right to me and got me out.
Mm-hmm.
But Warner was at the road in a vehicle waiting, and he said, oh, I was excited that you were not excited. I thought that was pretty. He says, I was excited that you were not excited. I thought that was pretty expressive.
And you were alone. I mean, you didn't have a hunting buddy.
No. You always do this alone.
Oh, really?
Deer hunting.
Mm-hmm.
Except father-son stuff. you know, I've taken one of my sons with me to stay here with me. But if two people cannot keep quiet or still, one person has a hard time doing it. You have to be almost hidden, and usually we'll pull brush, branches, twigs.
Right.
Some people go so far as to put a camouflage cloth over them, but I don't like to be where I can't see. And so I've learned how to be still enough. I've had deer come up and look me in the, as far from here as that lamp almost.
Mm-hmm.
Doe deer, but
sure, that you couldn't shoot.
Yeah, and then I twitch my eye and it snort and duck and run off.
All the pictures come to think of, and I've never deer hunted, obviously, of people on stands and what have you. It's always been solo.
Yeah. Now,
they get up in trees now.
A lot of hunters go up in trees, and I've done that too, but those are not safe unless they are built in. Now, a built tree stand, one is heavily constructed like a small tree house with a good strong ladder. I use those any day. But these things you buy commercially, they're
portable things. Yeah,
portable and put on. Well, I was coming down out of one of those with a rifle on my back one time, not too many years ago, and took three steps and it slipped around a tree and threw me off backward through the air with a rifle on my back. And I landed in a brush pile. Thankfully, I did not break anything.
Mm-hmm.
But
could have been rough, though.
Could have broken my back. Okay, that was the thing I remembered about that Arkansas hunt. And
I was so excited, too.
Yeah, I was excited because you were not excited. The only other incident I'm mentioning here is when his mother died, and I paid a pastoral visit to his home, and they were not at home, so I left a card in the door that I was so sorry I'd missed him, that I would call or come again. Well, I didn't have a chance to. The next morning, he came here, and he and I sat in the living room in there, and had a good, he was wearing his raincoat. It was kind of that kind of weather.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, how gracious of you to come and thank me for coming to see you.
Mm-hmm.
He, at that time, talked about his belief in the indestructibility of matter, which is a physicist's position.
Sure.
And he said, and because of that, I also believe that the human soul is indestructible. And he was talking about his faith and the immortality of the soul.
Mm-hmm.
Really,
with these scientific underpinnings.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
But was the kind of man he was. I always found him to be a gentleman and a gentle spirit and a kind person. I'm sure that there was another side to him that I didn't see. That, you know, I imagine he could be a pretty tough cookie, but when I was around him or with him, I always got the feeling that he was a man with a soul and with a spirit of gentle kindness,
mm-hmm.
And that he had a depth that was pretty solid, you know. So after he went with Fairchild and was in Washington, we corresponded a couple of times. He had, you know, while he was here, had sent invitation for me to go down to the Cape to see a firing, stag firing, and his secretary told me she would take care of arrangements and all, but I was never able to do that. My schedule didn't permit it, so I never saw a firing. excuse me, but I did correspond with him once or twice. Actually went to Washington, and I think after his illness, but that was such a, of course, quick thing and a real shock.
Right. Now, did he invite you to a firing, did you say, while you were, while he was here?
Yeah, while he was here in Huntsville.
But then in Fairchild, I mean, he was at Fairchild from 72 to 70.
Yeah, that was actually,
well,
he invited me to firing while he was still director of NASA here.
Right.
I
bet you probably regret that you weren't able to go.
Well, yeah, I would like to have been able to do that. But I regret a number of missed opportunities. I never got a an autograph from William Faulkner when I knew him, but I could have, but I didn't. I had one or two of his original, a couple of his autograph books that belonged to one of his sons, well, his Malcolm, his stepson, but I returned it, and of course.
Now, was your, I'm trying to remember if your home originally was Oxford or?
No, our home was Law, Mississippi.
Okay, all right.
And I went
to Starkville. Is that nearby? All right.
And when I was ordained in Mississippi, went to seminary from that diocese, came back, and the bishop sent me to Starkville. I was there 3 years, and then I went from Starkville to Ole Miss, and I was at Ole Miss from 54 to 57. And that's when I knew Faulkner. But then we came to Huntsville in July of 57 and been here ever since.
And married Barbara and me in August of 57.
Yeah, right. Right.
We were the first in the sanctuary where you did the honors.
Well, that, about a few
I'm
years
told
ago.
We were
by the way, congratulations, you're coming up on 50 years.
That's right. That's right. Well,
40.
Yeah. Well, coming up on, we celebrate our 41st already.
Yeah.
Yeah. 57. Yeah. The next one will be 42.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been at the paper going on 42 years.
Yeah.
A while. I've heard. You know, I've talked to, in this latest round of interviewing, before I'm through, I will have talked to about 40 people, probably, and gotten some wonderful stories.
Yeah.
And some would, I mean, they some of them showed me a little tougher side of Von Braun,
oh,
where
yeah.
he had to be a tough manager.
Yeah.
But there's not. And some of these people might be inclined to show me some warts, frankly, but no one has shared any example of mean-spiritedness or,
mm-hmm.
you know, unfair or, yeah, he had to be strong-willed at times.
Yeah.
And he had to sack a person or two, or arrange for a contractor to get the hell rid
yeah.
of a CEO of the company who was
yeah.
doing everything wrong,
right.
and had to do that kind of publicly because nothing else would work, and he did it. But it was not with evil intent, just
no,
guy standing in the way of the getting the job done.
I
follow
don't think
job.
He was a mean-spirited
Oh, and I'm not saying I ever thought he was, but...
No, I mean, you were reporting that other people
yes.
saw some evidence of it, and I never
and they didn't, and they really didn't. Just on the strength of will where he had to have that.
Mm-hmm.
And someone may have been hurt, but it wasn't without warning and without cause, just cause. Some others have told, I think Jim Daniels in town, and bless their hearts, you know, Jim was a writer and junior level manager with NASA. He's an excellent writer here and in Washington with Von Braun at his elbow for the 2 years he was at NASA headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he traveled with Dr. Von Braun and shared some religious views with him, but he and Dr. Von Braun talked a lot, and sometimes with the benefit of a little lubricant, a bottle of Chevis or whatever, and Von Braun, you know, expanded on that the order, the absolute order of the universe, and I've always felt this too,
the magnificence of creation compels you to believe in the magnificence of the Creator.
Yeah. He would approach it that way.
Mm-hmm.
As a one who appreciated the, I might say, the scientific structure,
mm-hmm.
basis of the universe. Well, you remember his assistant, his ghostwriter, who wrote a lot of speeches.
There were several, but Foster Haley and Guy Jackson, Joe Jones, who are some of the others?
No, I'm thinking about the one who was a member of Nativity, and the mother gave a lot of books in his memory when he died. I know this. I was with him almost from the time he died. I hate getting older and not being able to call up memory on my computer names like that. Ralph Jennings.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Yes.
Ralph
yes.
Jennings. Ralph was.
Indeed.
Ralph, I think, was apparently one who wrote a number of the speeches that Werner made. That doesn't say much about one himself, except that he put up with a lot from Ralph, because Ralph had an alcohol problem and died of it.
I've talked to Bonnie Holmes has always been quite private, shall we say.
Secretary.
Set for all those years.
Yeah.
And reticent, but she's opened up with a few appropriate recollections.
Yeah.
Pointed, humorous, and other anecdotes.
She's the one I talked to on the phone many times.
Mm-hmm. But she said he was just so kind to her, and some of the writers have told me that sometimes when he got thousands of requests to do articles, some minor for an obscure publication, limited interest publication, and some for This Week Sunday Supplement magazine,
mm-hmm.
and most of them he would buck to the staff of writers to do. They would submit a draft, and they to a person say, and he would mark it up, you know, and when it, although they had drafted it, when it was done, it sure had his imprint on it. But he would get an honorarium of $100 or $500 or whatever, and not something he sought, but they just paid the prevailing rates or whatever, and that many more times, more often than not, he would either send the check to them or write his personal check. If it was $100, write them a check for $50 and keep, you know, the 50,
mm-hmm.
because the man did not make a handsome salary. Here was this world figure who was on government wages, and he may have had a few sources of outside income, but he was extremely generous, and Bonnie said he would do that with her sometimes,
mm-hmm.
because he typed up manuscripts and they just endorsed the honorarium over to her.
Well, yeah, he did a number of occasions.
And you said to the church as well,
yeah.
for speeches. Oh, you mentioned your summoning your computer. He's credited with the great, remark in reply to this segment that was saying, we don't need to put man into space. Now that computers have developed, we just send robots out there, and it's so much cheaper. You don't have to have the life support systems and all of that.
He had a vision, didn't he?
Yes, but he realized there was a place for that.
Yeah.
But
But he also said man, because of his adaptability, is the most reliable computer there is that can be mass-produced with unskilled labor.
Yeah. Yes, sir, yeah.
That sounds like something he would say. I think he had a beautiful sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
He really did. He appreciated humor and used a lot of it.
I'm finding so many great examples of that. And of course, he was the complete Renaissance man in so many respects. He just had these inexhaustible intellectual interests
and cultural, yeah,
and cultural interests. Played the piano, played the cello rather well, and I guess his biggest hobby I can find is piloting. He just loved. At lunch today, John Guthrum Sr.
Mm-hmm.
came around. He had heard I was working on this and said, Von Braun once heard that John, they were out in California, I think it was, and were John was going to see kind of a private inventor who had come up with this hovercraft design. Not only design, he built a prototype kind of in his garage and just proving out the principles, and there was the thing rode on air cushions. Well, there had to be some engine blowers. There was a blower going down, and there was a blower ejecting out the back so it would go forward, and John was going to check this guy out, and Von Braun asked if he could go with John that day to this guy's house, and or that evening, and Von Braun had to flake out on a dinner engagement. It wasn't just with Von Braun, but he was going to go to a dinner that Donald Douglas of McDonnell Douglas Aircraft was putting on, and Von Braun, the guy was a friend, he'd been with him before, and he really didn't want to go to this dinner. He didn't have a part of the program, so he begged off and or feigned illness and met John in an alley. John came by and picked him up in a car. He said Von Braun was over there in a trench coat with his hat pulled down, so he wouldn't be seen by anybody going to this dinner he was supposed to. And they went to this guy's place, and he said, John said, and Von Braun was always so polite, he said, when he got there, he's like, he said, I didn't exist. He got with this inventor of the hovercraft and just immersed himself in that. I mean, John went and did what he needed to do, but when he, for hours, Von Braun was flying this thing in the driveway or something, that he loved to pilot anything he could get his hands on that got up off the ground, even if it's 2 feet. He was flying the thing, and just thriving in that atmosphere of novelty and innovation, and thinking, I'm sure, 20 years ahead, what this could become, you know.
I wonder what happened to that.
I'll have to ask John. I told him I was going to have to call him back to get a few more details, I wanted to use that. But he's flown, I've heard about him, anytime he went in a contractor's facility when they had a simulator, whether it was of the shuttle or of some test craft or this or that or the other, he wanted to fly all simulators, and there are a few good stories about him crashing the simulator repeatedly. Or if there was a test craft, a very different thing, and I don't mean a Mach 4, you know, that, but some kind of craft that he could go up in and get his hands on the control of some experimental craft, that he did it.
He should have been. He should have gone in space, of course, if there
was that have been
justice.
He had an adventurous spirit. What a waste for a man like that to die of cancer.
I know. Yesterday, got a call yesterday from a man named Edward Uhl, U-H-L, which is German for owl. Mr. Uhl went from a lieutenant to a lieutenant colonel in World War II on the American side, and he was the inventor of the bazooka. He was also a regular army officer, but early in his career, he invented the bazooka. And he and Von Braun became fast friends, and Von Braun, when he was so frustrated in Washington after 2 years, and there was some backstabbing going on and other things, called up Uhl, who had told him years earlier, if you ever want to join private industry, would you please call me? He was the CEO of Fairchild Industries, which you mentioned Fairchild earlier. And in 72, that would have been, he was the CEO of Fairchild.
I have a letter with Fairchild heading on it.
Oh, from Dr. Von Braun?
Yeah.
And, but I'd written Mr. Uhl about 2 weeks ago. I'd been given his name. This is somebody you ought to talk to. So he was very helpful. Also told me he called on Von Braun. Mr. Uhl may have had something to do with it. President Ford signed the paper awarding Dr. Von Braun the Presidential or National Science Medal when Von Braun had been dying with cancer 4 months in the hospital. So Mr. Uhl let Maria know about this, and Von Braun was so weak and emaciated, he couldn't leave the hospital to get the medal. So Ed took the medal there with everything signed by President Ford, and he said it was just so pathetic. And he gave him the medal, and he said tears came to Von Braun's eyes, and he said, you know, Maria, how about this? He said, this country has been so wonderful to me. He said, I came here with all my possessions in a cardboard box, somewhere between being an enemy and not yet being a citizen. And now, I'm given this wonderful award, and just tears everywhere. And I was so moved. I'm sure. I was scribbling like mad, talking to Mr. Uhl.
Right. What an interesting person that was.
Yeah.
Well, you've had some rare experiences with this, and I will be interested in seeing the book when it comes out.
Well, thank you. It will be before the middle of next year.
Yeah.
I don't know yet who's going to have the honor of publishing it. The Space and Rocket Center, the brand new director, has given me word that they'd like to be involved. They might want to underwrite it. I'm even thinking maybe the Times doing it. The Birmingham News has a book publishing arm. I could go with them. But I think there'll be enough. I mean, this is not going to be a 100,000 copy print run or anything, but I think there'll be enough interest to warrant limited edition.
I think a good sizable